walk through the system has to take place.
This
is the same subject, but myself, I
this is David Standard.
Contingency, because I'm trying to stay in charge of my own health, and would like that to continue until I'm gone. And from what you're saying, and from what I understand, that even a living will bears little weight. I may end up going to some other country for the rest of my life so that I can stay in charge of myself and my health. And that means not a lot of technological support in the last years of my life. So I just wonder if the task force, if this is another topic, it's like holding harmless seems like a major thing to do quickly, and whether or not there requires a refinement of state action that would also make living wills real, so that a person could have confidence that they could prepare a document that would designate the level of support they would get in their waiting years, and they could trust public support for that position so that they could stay in charge of their life as it faded out. I think that's if it takes more than just holding harmless, I think it ought to be done.
Appreciate Herb and David's comments.
As far as consumer information, if the committee has not heard this, organ retrieval, I think donors need to understand that they pay for the costs of that. Has that been mentioned to your committee?
Something I'm aware of, but yeah. Well, let's just keep rolling here. Mary Juki.
Hi, my name is Mary Juki, and I'm here just under for personal reasons. I don't represent anybody but myself and my husband, who is not here. But I find fault with, there's three things, let's hope I can remember them all. But the first one, I don't liken the insurance industry to the Titanic and an iceberg. I liken it to a cruise ship in the Bahamas. You know, I figure there's got to be some way to get that under control. It would seem to me it would solve an awful lot of problems and especially in the private industry. Well, I'm not for government regulations either. I really am not. We've had small businesses for quite a few years. Not always successful, but nevertheless, we keep trying. There's that American dream out there. And it would seem to me the private sector, sometimes it goes awry. Typical example, look at the mafia. That's a private adventure. And look what they're trying to do. I'm just having a real hard time with people hitting the problem on top of the surface. It seems to me you have to go beneath the surface to root out the problems. Anybody that can make that incredible much amount of money year after year and keep people at bay and keep lawmakers from improving upon anything, legislation, anything that can give anybody equal access or even good access, you know, to medical insurance or what have you. It would seem to me it needs to be done. It needs to be done quickly. So with those two things out of the way, you know, the third is I find it a little offensive when the medical, I have a doctor in my family, but I won't mention her name. But I still find it a little offensive when the medical community says it should all be on our shoulders to buy, insurance, medical insurance. You know, I stop and think, for one, in our business, we went to try to get insurance for the employer or employees as well as get us covered also, which at the time we didn't have, never have had, because of the expense. And I found, you know, that's an awful lot of money, month after month, year after year. And I'm thinking, okay, well, 25 years old, say you start at 25. By the time, when, realistically speaking, barring any unforeseen circumstances, when are you going to utilize this? If you, basic lifestyle that, you know, you're not drinking and driving, or, you know, sort of like that, you're probably not going to touch on it until you're, what, in your 60s? I don't know. It would just seem to me that's realistically speaking. So you start adding up all this incredible amount of money,
And this is for one contingency, that you get sick and all of a sudden you find yourself in the hospital and your house is on the auction block, your cars are already gone because I'm sure the doctors or whatever have that, as well as the lien on the house. And I'm thinking to myself, it's almost insulting to me for somebody to say that, you know, we have to have this, and shame on you for not having it. You know, being, God, I'm almost 40 years old, and I still don't have health insurance, and I haven't had since my stepfather retired from, well, no, it's when I was 18 and they cut me off. It was another 15 years till he retired. So I've only been covered under that plan. Everything else has been out of pocket. So $300, and we're just a couple. We don't have children. I would hate to think what that bill would be for every month, putting that sort of money into something. Where? Is there interest on it? No. Can I draw out on it if I need to do something? No. Is it at the end of the year? Can I list it on my assets in the column? No, it's gone. It's money that you just open the window and blow it away. Now, if I had any, and hey, we didn't even touch on that. What happens if I do have a problem and I know about it, and I am lucky enough to get insured? As soon as I go to the hospital for something like that, either my rates are going to go up here, or I'm going to get kicked out the window, and I'm going to have to go hunt for somebody else to carry me. Where is the logic behind this? You know, I'm just so infuriated at the whole system. It's terrible, especially when I just spent $10,000 for a little surgery that I was only in the hospital for 2 days, operating room for an hour. $10,000, come on. You know, where's the, give me some comparisons here. For $10,000, I can show you something that I would have much rather walked home with instead of lost. You know, so when you look at it on my level, number one, like I say, I'm not intimidated. I don't think the insurance companies are on the verge of going broke. There's no way, Jose. They've been in business far too long, and they're far too strong to be anywhere near financial difficulties, especially when they're, geez, they're buying small countries for crying out loud. You know, I mean, how can they be going broke? So why can't we do something to address my sort of problem? I don't have insurance, and I'm not, you know, we need something, you know, so that for us little folks, you know, just the little people that have never had and wish they could, type thing. And it doesn't mean I'm foregoing $200,000 or $250,000 house. $54,000 is what the tax lists my house for. I drive an 88 car. It doesn't sell probably for $5,000 on the market right now. I'm not foregoing insurance to live a high and affluent lifestyle. You know, that is the basic truth for a lot of folks in this city, right, in this country. And I agree with the gentleman who said there's a lot of other countries that have a lot better plans, and they've implemented. They haven't talked about it. They've implemented them. So why isn't that forthcoming? Even some ideas, anything. That's it.
Thanks, Barry.
Thanks.
Sorry, can I get your name? That's
not good. I made it to TV. Ron Cavallo.
It's all setting up. My name's Ron Kovalik. I just got $20,000 worth of medical bills in the last year to deal with a kidney problem. As far as I'm concerned, I got decent medical care. I have been buying insurance since I was 20 years old. I worked for a large organization for a while. They provided insurance. When I got done with them, I tried to buy insurance again. They said they would not cover my kidney problem. I have a pre-existing condition, even though I had insurance with the same company since I was 20 years old. I feel that if our government was the least bit serious about doing something about the medical problem, they would demand that any company selling insurance in our state would have to take their percentage of the assigned risks. An example that tells me that they're not the least bit concerned about us is they can't even demand a standardized form. Every insurance company has a different form. And I've heard plenty of medical people complaining about having to fill out 17 different kind of forms. That's so basic, it's infantile. And I don't think that any of us should expect any improvement as long as our government is bought and sold. Our elections are bought and sold. The lobbyists go down there and they can get what they want. You and I can't get what we want because they don't care about us. We can't come up with a $50,000 campaign donation. Why should we expect that our government is going to help us as long as they're bought and sold?
Is that it?
Is that plain enough?
Yeah. Pretty straightforward. We're not any longer on teleconference either, but just a little in defense, I mean, there are some limitations. The industry doesn't just buy and sell, folks. There are campaign, you know, limitations at the federal level. Corporate donations can't be made at the federal level. At the state level, there's a $1,000 limitation. So, I mean, but the point you make is a very, very good point, and that is that the special interest, not including the insurance industry, have a tremendous impact on the whole process. And that has been a reason why we in the state of Alaska didn't see major and comprehensive reform last year, is that the not only the insurance industry, but the docks and the facilities and all, virtually every interest that has a stake at the table or a stake in the set of issues kept things in a major or comprehensive way from passing. And the idea was that kind of wait and let the federal government, let's see what shakes out at the federal level, and then make sure also that everybody's at the table losing a pound of flesh in the exercise. And until that, so I think something's probably going to change, something will occur, but clearly the special interests have a lot to say about what doesn't happen.
Well, an example, our local election here in the borough just now, ARCO got in, Alyeska got in, and one other, MAPCO, got in. To decide who's on the borough assembly. And this is a two-bit borough. What do we have to do with the oil industry? Just think what they're doing in Juneau.
It's a horror story.
I'd like to comment in that vein. I think we need as citizens, we need to recognize that we have to change our own attitudes. There's almost nothing I can think of in the way of a valued part of our lives that we don't think can be commercialized, that we aren't ready to see have access to from the free market. You could name almost any value that we hold, religious, medical, you know, name it all. And we have no sense of restraint about whether it's healthy or not in our own personal lives to have us like to support those actions in the social sense that allow for commercialization of any part of our lives that's accessible. And I think that we're suffering the consequences. We end up ciphers in the money machine. So I think we really need ourselves individually to seek out the limits that we want to recognize. And maybe there's limits on turning everything into a money value.
Who gets the questionnaire?
If you just leave them for us here.
I think that I would share some of your frustration and skepticism, and especially relating to a recent comment we heard from one of the insurance companies, because the committee's been working for quite a while to try to develop some recommendations on community rating. One of those recommendations would be that they couldn't exclude you for an existing condition if you've already been excluded ever in your life for that condition. Or they could, you'd have a minimum of a 6-month wait one time. When the two largest insurance companies were invited to the meeting tomorrow to comment, one of them commented that they didn't think they wouldn't show up because they weren't going to support it anyway, so we couldn't. It'd be much easier to not support if they just didn't show up for meaningful dialogue. I find those kind of comments offensive, and I find them insulting to the people of the state.
May I make one more comment? I'm sure everybody here has listened to different kind of talk shows, but on national talk shows, they invite in a lawyer, a doctor, and an insurance man. And they say, what should we do about our medical problem? And all we have is pointing fingers around the table. These are the smartest people in our country, and they're not putting forward any solutions. And I suggest they have a gravy train. Why should they want to change it? It's not in their interest.
Any other comments?
Just based on reliable sources, not my own research,
comments about where the insurance companies stand in terms of profit and not profit and whether they're sinking or on a cruise ship. Apparently, the best kept secret in the country is their financial statements. Nobody can get hold of annual reports for the insurance company. Nobody really has an idea of what their profit margin is. Yep.
Go ahead, Dave.
I think, though, that when you talk about insurance, too, you have to look at not only profit, but basically the cost. I mean, there are hundreds and hundreds of people pushing paper in the American medical system. And, I mean, everybody that works for insurance companies is not making a lot of money, that's for sure. But there may be ways that we can reform the system to eliminate some of that. There was a GAO report that examined the Canadian health system in 1991, which basically said that the amount of money that we spend, if we could streamline the administrative cost in the American system, we could use those funds to extend coverage to all Americans and probably reduce the average deductible level that Americans have now on top of that. So it's not just profits, but it's how much money goes to non-productive enterprise.
Well, Ron's suggestion about standard form and things seem just basic.
Right, and those are being, those are suggestions that are being implemented in different states. And New York has a very comprehensive proposal, which is called Unicare, where everybody has to use not only a standard form, but just a wallet card with an ID number on it that you just run through, and everything's done just like credit cards now. So to also try to eliminate waste and push your paper.
On this subject right here?
I've just got two
what,
things.
Your name for the record and
Wendy Ray. Agent. And one thing she was saying about insurance, I heard on a PBS show, the Career Report, how they had a State Farm CEO was on there, and he wanted to let his policyholders know that there would not be a price increase because of the hurricanes, because they have $18 billion in reserves for things like that. And I thought, $18 billion, and yet my auto and health and everything went up State Farm? I thought that was really ridiculous.
That's an important point, though, is that insurance companies know risk. And when I have a claim, their check better be in the mail, and it better be there tomorrow. And everybody wants lower cost, and everybody wants the insurance companies to be a black hole where you reach in and grab money out. But that policy money that they have control over, they're expecting to pay out a significant amount of that money that they have in reserves over the coming year, the next year, and the year after that. And I'm not saying that all insurance companies are like that. They're not the benevolent protector of the widow and orphan, as they would lead us to believe. That's not the case. And there's a lot of waste there, just in the paper shuffling, like you mentioned. Non-productive activity. Activity that is not getting the tongue depressor down the child's throat. Activity that is not educating somebody about a better lifestyle. But the insurance companies are definitely not a black hole that we can reach into and just start scooping money out and throwing at this problem. They're not. And when I talk about them being a bunch of rich guys on the Titanic, I speak specifically about the healthcare issue, because they're, the auto insurance, homeowners insurance, those costs are fairly predictable over time. Though we may see increases over a particular level of time. But when you see an increase of 30% a year, year after year, that's scary to anybody.
Thanks, Pat Shearer. This is just for the record. Yeah, Ron?
John.
John, excuse me.
Have you looked at the Minnesota bill yet?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Because that's one of the big things that they've gone for is streamlining administration. Right. They also recommend reducing the amount of insurers competing in the market and seeking relief from antitrust laws. Have you got any plans about that?
They've just enacted it early in the summer, so we've yet to see most of that, what the effects may be, but literally getting people, the five kind of representative interests represented by members of the legislature into a room and knocking heads is how that happened. I'm sure that you'll probably see some bills introduced in their next legislature to undo some of the things that were done.
Yeah, but several of the things that Minnesota did pass are also recommendations that the task force recommended in the interim, which died a bad death in the state Alaska state legislature. And as Mark said, we had a chance to talk to one of their senators, who was one of the gang, what they called the Gang of Six, that actually shepherded the Minnesota bill through. And it was a major effort, a consumer effort, that got the Minnesota legislation passed. That was the reason and the difference for the passage of the Minnesota law.
David? Yeah, I have a comment, too, on what happened. The one party that I think is critical for health care reform that has been conspicuously absent from our discussions really has been the governor. The governor in this state, you know, the states that are showing a strong interest, Vermont passed health care reform, but Vermont's governor is a physician, so he had a particularly strong position. But the governor of the state of Washington, where the governor has shown leadership, there has been, I think, effective reform. We have, I think, been less successful in getting the governor interested in this problem. And I don't know. I don't know why. Maybe it's somebody said it's because all his friends have health insurance, you know. But
it's true.
He has to hear from the people of Alaska. We have to have someone to take leadership to. That's a plea, please.
And David's point was highlighted when we had our first summer meeting, and the commissioner of the Department of Administration, who was on our task force, when we kind of went around the room, said, "We're not sure that there's a problem." And this is after having sat on the task force for almost a year. They're still not clear as an administration that there's a problem, that there's a need, and largely because the public constituency for it is invisible. We're not owning the problem or the solution. Again, Pam, on this subject?
Yeah, I'm Pam Muth. And I guess I have a problem with that because I work in the field of public health, and many of the people that we deal with are not good advocates for themselves. And I think it would be very valuable for the Commissioner of Administration to perhaps go to one of the public health centers and spend a week there and find out who comes in. There are those people out there, and we have ways to show them if they're willing.
Let's move through the last couple of folks that have signed up, and then we can. This is very good for us, but let's go through Mike Mayberry.
For the record, my name is Mike Mayberry. I'm the president-elect for the staff council of the University of Alaska. University of Alaska is also wrestling with this health care problem. I hear a lot of people saying that they can't get coverage because they're a small company. Well, the University of Alaska statewide employs over 3,500 people. They went out to bid a few years ago looking for health care for their employees. Only one company responded. You would think a group of 3,500, you'd have a little bit more than one response to a bid. And yet there was the person that responded and eventually got the bid, lucky us. Anyway, and our health care costs have gone in 1989 from $3,484 per person to projected 1995 of $6,355 per person.
Run those numbers by me, Andy.
It's from 89, it's $3,484. And projected in 95 at the current trend is $6,355 per employee. Of course, the university's not going to pay all of that, so it's the employees are, we're just starting to have some meetings on our health care and figure out what the employees and the employer can do to kind of bring these things in line. And one of the things we ran across was a draft report that UAF coordinating committee made on wellness report is what we call it, and that's for care that you have. If you take care of yourself and implement programs, exercise program for the employees, and nutritional counseling, and different things like that, that would reduce the medical costs and prevent maintenance care, and they have to evaluate that and see if it's going to actually lower the cost now or not. But It was just something I wanted to throw out as a wellness thing, and I'll let you make some copies of this if you want to look it over. There's a lot of good references.
In fact, that we'd like to have that graph there.
Sure, you could have all this is all put out by the university relations people so that the employees would have a better understanding of what they were dealing with. And it looks like the employees are going to start picking up some of their own health care, or they're going to do a thing called a menu where you would go through and have a set amount of money, and you would pick the coverage that you need as a family or an individual and pay for that accordingly, so that everybody's not paying for things they don't need.
Yeah. Mike's point is not, the state was in a similar situation. Our contract, a three-year rolling contract, was up a little over a year ago now. It was rebid and takes, you know, months, 8, 9, 10 months before that whole bidding process is done. We have 15,000 plus employees plus dependents to cover. It's almost a $90 million policy per year, and we only got one respondent. So,
part of that I found was in our deliberations with this joint health care cost containment committee, whatever, was the stipulations placed upon the state by ERISA required the state to offer certain policy provisions that most insurers did not want to look at, such as no limits for substance abuse treatment.
Right.
Correct.
The state is prohibited from doing that, and yet that's 25% of the cost.
And growing.
And growing. And some of those, you know, need repeat offenders, whereas a reasonable level, the care providers have told us that a reasonable limit would actually help them treat people because they would be able to say, this is it. You can't come back. But as it is now, some of those repeat offenders just realize when the pressure comes that they can get a 30-day paid vacation and return to their jobs. That's just one of the things. When our bargaining group was looking at becoming a self-insured trust, out of, I think, 60 letters sent out to different third-party administrators of interest, we received 58 responses in writing form, and not a small number of phone calls saying, when can we fly up there and meet with you guys? We want to talk to you right now.
Right. I think that's a good point. Working on the state employee health insurance task force, the real important difference between what the university has and what the state had at the time was not only did they have no limits on substance abuse, but there were virtually no limits in the plan. None of the kinds of normal things that they do have now. And so they were the carrier was taking a great risk. In this case, the carrier is only a third-party administrator. They only pay the claims, and there is no risk to the carrier. So I have no idea why you only got one bid on it.
Don't ask me. I wasn't involved in the bid process.
I just don't think we are that unattractive a market. You know, I just, again...
Well, I think if we get everybody at the table, the insurers, the care providers, and the users, and come up with a compromise, I think we'd be in good shape. And we saw that when we sat down with our current administrator and said, we're thinking about dumping you guys and we become a trust. Immediately, instead of, you know, when we first sent this letter out, it was a letter of, you know, intent. We got a letter back from our current carrier saying, thanks very much for your interest. Stop by and see us next time you're in Seattle. We said, wait a minute, we're talking about taking a huge piece of your business away. When they finally realized that we were serious, they had people on the airplane knocking on our door. Can we talk with you guys? Can we buy you breakfast? Can we do this? Can we say that? And then they offered, hey, we can do the same plan that you're currently buying through all this administration hierarchy that we're having to deal with for 20 to 25% less.
Patrick, when you say administration, you mean within the Department of Administration? Where does it
manifest?
Right
now it's set up where the state and the carrier contract to cover an outside group of people, which is the employees. And to be able to deal directly with that group, to be able to structure the plan with a self-insured group with a limit on substance abuse type treatments and not have to go through retirement benefits, they said they could provide the same plan with that minor adjustment for 20-25% less.
Well, as you're going through contract negotiations now, right, you've just begun that whole process with the state, this is a major piece of it. The insurance people, I mean, our provider tells us we've got to get a handle on managed mental health, or, you know, set some of these limits and all that type of stuff. They're saying that those are negotiable items, that we, our negotiators, ought to be negotiating hard stances.
The administration tried to get legislation passed last session. It went past the House, and it died in the Senate at midnight, to allow the state to self-insure,
right,
which would remove some of those limits on them as far as having no say over how much is spent on substance abuse, et cetera. Hopefully, maybe that can happen this time through, and we will realize the savings. I should also point out that even though the state was only paying $386 per person,
it's pretty good.
Per month.
Yeah, per month.
It was per...
They ate up over $12 million in surplus in that plan in order to subsidize that rate. That rate was actually much higher.
Right.
And so when the state says, we kept the cost down over the last few years, that was not accurate.
And on the subject of substance abuse, just one of the inadequacies that we were looking at our plan was we have it listed under mental health. They pay 80% up to 365 days for an inpatient, but only 50% for up to 50 visits a year as an outpatient. So they're telling you they'd rather have you locked up in a hospital somewhere than to work on yourself on an outpatient basis.
Inversely.
It should be the other way around. You should pay 80%.
How did those kind of provisions get lobbied in?
I mean, they said, I just inherited this thing here last week. I'm just trying to figure out a solution like you are.
These same things happen, why home health care isn't paid for, but being in a nursing home is, that same kind of mentality.
David, and then we're going to move on to the next person.
Yeah, I think one of the things that the task force has found out, though, is that controlling health care costs for all the small pieces is not going to work. It's like stepping on a water balloon. When you push down one place, the cost is still in the system, and it pushes up somewhere else. Providers are then stuck with this horrible cost shifting where they're continually asked to offer discounts for large groups, and they end up offering discounts to those groups, but they may have to pass those costs on somewhere else because it doesn't make it any cheaper to provide the care. So I guess one of the things that we've learned and that we're committed to is that any type of solution to cost can't be done by one small segment. I mean, if the university controls cost to the extreme because they're a big group and a gorilla in the marketplace, well, then those costs are still there. They have to be passed on somewhere else. So, you know, people's behavior has to shift. There has to be more responsible use of the resources. And just trying to control costs by trying to negotiate the best deal won't work. It hasn't worked. It hasn't worked in the state. It doesn't work for the providers. And it really makes it more and more unfair for the person without insurance. In California, in 1989, the average fee in a hospital in San Jose went up 70%. It went up 70%, but nobody paid that except for the person that had no insurance. All the insurance companies negotiated these 15, 20, 30, 40, 50% discounts, so the hospital raised their fees to get their costs back, and then the guy that had no insurance at all was hit with this bill that was 70% higher. That was in one year. Cost shifting of that magnitude has not happened up here, but I think everybody has to realize that that is something that could happen if we don't adopt a comprehensive solution to the problem. You know, that's something that we've recognized, and that you just can't do it a little piece at a time.
Pat Shearer, then we're going to go to an end of...
I can wait.
On that point, was it specific?
Well, on that point, you know, there is a risk, though, on the other end of that pendulum that... look at our education system right now. In the elementary and secondary education, we have a virtual monopoly that is basically government-directed and controlled. And there are many private schools springing up, and I think they're becoming more popular as some people are concerned about the education that their children may be getting. And I see a parallel in a national health care program that we somehow have to be very, very careful that maybe as Marlene mentioned, that we should leave the market alone with a basic plan with the providers agreeing to some limits on costs that they'll charge, with the insurance companies saddling themselves with some productivity, standardized forms, that sort of thing, with users being sensitive to the cost by carrying a deductible, and then having the government plan limited to catastrophic coverage. You know, I'm not saying that's the solution, that's just a suggestion. With the mind, with an eye toward what we're looking at now in our education system.
Anita.
I'm Anita Bush. I wear two hats. I'm a critical care nurse at Fairbanks Memorial Hospital. I'm also an instructor at the university. I don't work enough hours at the university to qualify for their health plan, however. So I'm partially insured. I've heard in the comments tonight people holding up as possibility the Oregon plan and reluctantly admitting that it's a plan on rationing. And I think it's time we admit that what we have now is rationing, mm-hmm. and it's based on your ability to pay. And I agree with Roger and Marlene in that I don't think we should mandate business to do anything other than make widgets. We have to figure out a better way. And I've heard Patrick say that everybody's got a plan for health care reform. This group's got this plan. This group's got this plan. And I say, great. I'm excited so many people are looking at the system, at the problems, and at potential solutions. Put your ideas out on the table, and then we have something to discuss, something to work from. And Mark, in your opening remarks, you were talking that we... in the process of addressing these problems, of getting the costs down and increasing access to the service that we already have, we must realize that you need a provider there to deliver the service, and this country is facing, at least in my profession, a profound shortage of nurses, which the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services just released an opinion 60 days ago is projected to go well into the 21st century. Alaska has wonderful university facilities. Let's use them and stop importing healthcare workers. We have the facilities here in the state. We can educate some of the healthcare workers the state requires in the state much more cost effectively. It has not been that many years ago that Providence Hospital in Anchorage had to close neonatal intensive care beds because they did not have the nurses. They had the facilities. They had the equipment, they had the physician, but they did not have sufficient nurses to keep the beds open. That's money gone out of the state that needn't have. We have campuses at Anchorage, we have campuses on the Fairbanks campus where there are adequate, appropriate resources to educate the healthcare providers that we need, some of which are nurses, which to work in the federal and state positions require the baccalaureate. The associate degree program will not cut it. So if you're talking about sending people out into the villages to do well baby checks, to do general health, to do immunizations, you need the baccalaureate prepared people. There is also a program in the state budget to pay Alaskan residents to go outside to obtain education that cannot be obtained in the state. For the $70,000 that you are spending per nurse that you send out this state, you could pay a full-time instructor 1 year and teach 12 people. Let's use our money wisely.
A couple of points before you leave there. The Board of Regents, I understand, has made a decision, tentative or not, I'm not sure which, to cease the nursing program at the Fairbanks campus in the next fiscal year. And you might want to share what you know or don't know about that. And then also
I
the program...
already have.
Yeah, okay. But also the WAMI program that you're mentioning is one that's been fairly aggressively lobbied by the Washington Medical School. And Karen and I participated in a forum during the early summer. And the WAMI folks were starting to take some attention or make some attention because they're concerned that we're going to stop funding. It's a $1.2 million general fund appropriation last year, I think it's in that neighborhood anyway, that could clearly be used for support of our own institution. So they're conscious of that, but still we haven't seen much coming from that school.
One of the comments Patrick made is maybe we should open up all the medical schools in the country to everyone who could make an A. And I would urge you, when you're considering your recommendations, to carefully consider what is health and what is health care. The absence of pathology is not necessarily health. And other providers besides physicians can provide certain health care services within the scope of their license. Nurses, practitioners, advanced practitioners of various forms are cost-effective providers.
The key, though, is they need to be paid for their services. And we currently cannot
have them first.
But we cannot.
There's one geriatric nurse practitioner in the whole state. That's ridiculous.
The new Denali Center has a room and facility and resources set up for a geriatric nurse practitioner, but we only have one in the state. We do not have access to importing necessarily that particular provider.
I have a question.
Go ahead, Karen, first.
I was just going to make a comment on, I think as a pharmacist, we would like to be paid to not fill prescriptions for people. I mean, we don't get paid unless we fill a prescription because that's where our where our payment is. But sometimes people don't really need to get all the medicine they do. They're just taking what they've got improperly. But we don't get paid for the time that we spend. And I think that sometimes some of these, along with the nurses and some other professions, sometimes we don't get paid for our time. We just get paid for some product
or
that we deliver. And I think that maybe we should realize that payment for time sometimes is more worthy than the actual something tangible. It's an intangible, but there is a value to it.
Karen?
It's a good point. But on another question, we had heard that the Alaska Nurse Practices Act is a model act, that it provides the broadest range of scope of practice. Is that generally your impression?
Yes, it is.
We've gone as far as we can go with that?
They're probably...
Teresa
Lyons. There are probably less than 10% of the nurses... that hold a baccalaureate degree in nursing in the state that are practicing at the full scope of their licensure because of our work environments and because of where the dollars go.
Mm-hmm.
Our productivity is measured by the number of beds that are filled.
Mm-hmm. So it is a money issue. It's not an
absolutely
issue.
Absolutely.
Of their licensure.
Okay.
But I would just like to add in terms of plans, there was a poll, the results of a poll published in U.S. News and World Report the end of September, that nursing's agenda for healthcare reform was second only to AARP in national believability for effecting real change.
Mm.
Teresa Lyons again. The other thing about nursing's agenda is that while it is an agenda for measuring legislation, it's not actually an agenda for creating legislation.
No.
We use it to actually look at the legislation that comes out of the states or the national level and measure them up against the pieces of criteria that we believe need to be there.
Thank you. Doctor?
I'll probably get shot for this opinion.
You're surrounded.
Probably could have been shot many times before tonight. But,
this is Roger Hart.
I feel that the WAMI program has been a nice thing for us, but from a strictly utilitarian viewpoint, I think the money could much be better spent on ancillary healthcare professionals. I am lacking laboratory technicians. We are down in our nurses. I'm sure that there are many other healthcare professionals that the state needs more than physicians. At the moment, it seems that the most justifiable cause for the WAMI program is that an Alaskan student has an opportunity for a medical education. Now, that's not to be dismissed, but I think that if we could provide them the opportunity, we might better spend the money trying to encourage
other training opportunities.
This is probably the best group to make that statement
in. Yeah. Just a quick...
Well, I recognize it all is going to get back to my constituency.
Just a quick thing on the WAMI program. And, of course, I don't know if it makes sense for Alaska for the very long future to have their own medical school. So we are, you know, we've done the sensible thing in consorting. But the data that's being published now by WAMI is kind of... it's kind of indicative of what's happening in the medical profession, which is that they're graduating, about half of their graduates are in primary care, which has been their strength. But only 9% of those graduates are going to practice in underserved areas. Mm-hmm. And the majority, you know, across the nation, as you look at medical schools, graduates are choosing, they're not choosing primary care, but if they are choosing it, they're not choosing to practice in places like Alaska or in rural, what we would call rural areas, and I think Fairbanks is one of those. And one of the reasons, not every reason, but one reason is, again, the reimbursement, the way reimbursement is viewed. It's very tough. You know, federally, they consider it cheaper to deliver care in rural areas than in urban areas. Mm-hmm. And so hopefully some of those things are starting to be addressed and looked at as we look at shortages of physicians. The only place that they're showing a shortage of physicians is in rural areas and in primary care. So.
Well, thank goodness for Northern Exposure.
Right.
We've worked through the list of people who indicated that they wanted to make some comments. Are there others who want to make some formalized comments on the record? Yes.
I'm going to say one thing. My name is Ann Swift. I'm a nurse. I work in a variety of different settings. And also, I get my insurance through my husband from the university. And I wanted to say something when he was talking, that my big thing is prevention. As prevention is would save everybody a lot of money. The university, when you go to the doctor, there's a little square of that says, is this a routine physical examination? If you check that, they won't pay. We've had university insurance for like 30 years now, almost 30 years my husband's worked there. And I've learned, you go to the doctor, you make sure they put a diagnosis on there, even though I believe my age, I think a model like the Andrew Isaac Health Center is the way to deliver health care, where everybody sees a good number practitioner or a family practitioner to start with. Then they get referred on to, and they have a set clientele, they can remind people it's time to come in for shots. I mean, that's appreciated, you know. And then they're referred on to a specialist if they need to have one. It's a very sensible way to deliver health care. And it takes care of the prevention and settles looking for a doctor. And, you know, a lot of people go to the emergency room because they don't have a doctor.
Or they don't have insurance.
But, you know, that's the thing. And that's not the appropriate place.
No.
So I just would have reiterated that prevention would save an awful lot of money for everybody if we focus on prevention instead of focusing on being sick.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, in justification of my earlier statement, a lot of people covered with native health care go to the emergency room. My earlier statement is it's an individual responsibility. And when you have a system that essentially is wound to the tomb coverage, everything paid for, that it is not cost efficient.
And
I agree with Roger that I think individual responsibility always plays absolutely the number one key position in all of this. And as I said, I think Andrew Isaac is a model for care with some changes. And I'd like to say that some of the reasons that people end up in the emergency room is because we have physicians on call who are supposed to take calls at night and decide whether they should end up in the emergency room. And might choose not to get out of their own warm bed and or give good directives over the phone. So I'm not saying the individual isn't responsible, but I think as providers, we don't teach the way that we should sometimes. We don't give the guidance that this could wait to another time. I think a part of the care that needs to change
and I've been sort of dropping little hints and probably wage a campaign fairly soon, is that our consumers to that system don't know the value of the care that they're getting. Mm-hmm. I think they should get a little receipt every time they walk in the door and see what great service they just got. Mental health services, dental services, nursing services, physician services, and then we contract to private physicians in the town. Most of our consumers never have a clue that $30,000 was just spent on their health care, their stay in intensive care. So I feel that we, again, but I saw healthcare, I saw bumper stickers. I came in on the back of somebody's truck out there. It said, teach peace. I think we should start teaching health, and we don't teach health. We don't teach people to have responsibility for themselves. We don't give them tools for decision making. The year 2000 goals for the schools, there's nothing about health in there from what I understand. Does anybody know more about that?
Well, they figured that it was Choice Alliance. I think they figured that it was covered under Healthy People 2000. It has been a mandate that's been out for two or three years now, at least, that NIH is using for funding for research.
And I'm not knocking the school curriculum because I think it's been hard won, but it actually teaches, gets taught, varies a lot from teacher to teacher. I know my youngest son is in a grade 9 health class right now, and we have many amusing discussions in the evening about what he learned that day in health. And it's really sad.
It's a broad definition.
They play with their health wheel, or their wellness wheel, that's what it's called. And some of the principles are okay, but the meat of the matter is really, we have a lot of work to do.
Yes.
My name is Wendy Ray, and I guess what I keep hearing from a lot of people, and I've worked for quite a few doctors in the community here. I am working for a private practice doctor right now, so I know basically what a lot of the doctors make here in town. And a lot of people say we need to cap physician fees. But I think before you cap physician fees, you need to cap malpractice fees. Some doctors are paying over $100,000 a year just for malpractice, and that has to come out to somebody because each system doesn't have in the bank to throw away $100,000. I think medical supplies are outrageous. I know one supply that we have to buy costs us about 70% more or 100% more than what a veterinarian can buy it for. Same product but labeled differently. You know, and so I think, you know, capping a physician's fee is fine, but I think you just can't ask physicians to cap their fees because their expenses are going higher also. You know, and I think that people could say that physicians are just gouging the public, but also physicians are being gouged by, you know, medical equipment, medical supplies, rent, malpractice insurance, and also wages. You know, to keep people, they have to pay them. And I know a lot of places in the town go through a lot of personnel because they can't afford to pay people to stay employed with them.
What I was going to say is that one of the objectives of the task force really is not to stop any increase in the growth of cost in healthcare. I think we're probably a little bit more realistic, and what we really want to try to do is just slow it down to the same rate of inflation that everything else is going up. And that sounds like a not very ambitious undertaking to let it go up at the same rate as everything else. But if you look at the trends and you do that, you save over $1 billion a year by the end of the decade just by slowing it down in this state alone. So everybody feels like that that the providers are having more cost. And I think the other thing that we're really trying to do is is work with the professional groups to slow down the rate of increase by helping to educate people for better use of care and for providing people for incentives to use their health care more wisely. But I think what we're striving for is just to get it to the same rate of increase as the general inflation in the economy. Mary?
Addressing pretty much that same topic, being, again, an uninsured civilian, you know, going out there, whenever I go to the doctor, I have to specifically tell them, right as soon as I get through the door, I am not insured. I do not have insurance. And I've played the game both ways. I have gone to different, through the years, I tell them specifically, I am not insured. Oh, boy, I do have their attention. Because that means they stop right there and they quit writing. Because what they were doing was writing out all these tests. They're listening to me and they don't have. And as soon as I tell them I don't have insurance, it, you know, that paper goes in the file, 13, and then we get down to the nuts and bolts of it. Okay, well, let's see. I think this test is probably all you're going to need. And then if that doesn't, then we'll go from there. And when I go in, when I don't say anything, boy, I'm telling you, they have me go into each and every room, and by the time the whole thing's through, I don't even want to look at the bill. But I only made that mistake once. The only time I made that mistake before I told the doctor. And that is true. Why is it that when you have an animal and you have a sibling or a brother, husband, whatever, you give that same identical medicine to your pet? And you just filled it down there at the pharmacy, and they charged you 50 cents for that pill. But when you go down and put a human name on it and a MD instead of a DVM on the tag end of the doc, you know, on the physician, you're charged upwards of $9 for that same tablet. Now, why is that? That's a very good question. I'm glad you raised that. And you're the same. If you have your urine run through a test or the, you know, whatever, that is a different charge. It is the same identical test, and it's just the difference between one's got four legs and one's got two. That's the only difference I can see.
Linda, you have a comment first, then Patrick.
I'm just going to stand up here so I can see. My name is Linda Holbert. I've been in health education and social services in Fairbanks for a long time, but I've recently changed roles, and I work in the health insurance field. Some people smiling.
I've been thinking about you the whole night.
And, you know, what agents are is they're trying to get you the coverage you want for a price you can afford. And it's really hard to do. Because in the last 3 years that I've been doing this, I've observed that our technology has outpaced our ability to pay for it. So what do we do about it? How do we deal with inflation and medical inflation when there's so many more things you can do? It was brought home to me this year with the birth of a premature child that I worked with. Now that child cost $750,000 in its first 4 months of life. What normalcy there will be, what the eventual projections are, no one knows. But technologically, 3, 4, 5 years ago, this child would not have survived. The largest claims I've seen have not been on older people. They've been on younger people in accidents. They've been premature children. They've been aneurysms, those kinds of things. $300,000 in claims in the first 6 months on someone. So, I mean, I see it from both sides of the fence. We say preventative care is important, and some companies are doing preventative care, and they are emphasizing it. But you have to have a long-term relationship for that company to see some benefit from that preventative care. Mm-hmm. And when people tend to hop from company to company to company, that company is not saving a lot of money by paying preventative care up front, because they're paying a lot up front. They're never going to see the savings in the end, because your chances of being insured by that same company aren't really there. I've seen some outstanding companies that can't be canceled no matter how much you use it. High deductibles with people taking a lot of responsibility but having excellent quality care. So there are the carriers, and there are people who are your agents who work really hard to try and get you what you want with something you can afford. But the reality is that the cost of the hospital and the doctor is very high, and the technology is very high, and also we have increasing fraud. So when you have fraud and technology and everything else added together, I don't justify the cost. I'm just trying to get people what they need for what they can afford. But you see it from a real broad spectrum, and it's really hard to say, what are we going to do? My personal opinion is that we have some hard choices to make. Where are we going to take technology? Are we going to spend 50% of the money, 50% of the cost that some companies have quoted to me is spent on someone in their last year of life? Where do we want our priorities? Do we want them in prevention and prenatal care and care for young children to have good health? I think we need to reallocate a lot of our health resources. But it sure is not, because truly I believe that our technology is totally outpaced our capacity for work. And how we make the choices, I don't know. I think it mind boggles everybody. How do we change a system that's big and broad that affects everybody so much? I don't have any answers. I just see a lot of different cases, and I'd like to be able to see things serve a majority of people better with prevention, with emphasizing good health,
our system isn't doing it now, but it's real strange because I see a lot of young people with huge high claims when we allow people to drive uninsured. And then I just had a quasi-member of my family have almost an $80,000 medical bill because it was hit by an uninsured motorist, you know, fault of his own, and the motorist was negligent. Nothing's going to happen to that motorist. He's not going to pay the bills. He's going to get away with maybe loss of the license. But we're not building responsibility in a lot of our different ways. So I would just encourage people to get together and work hard. I am housed with one company, and I've asked people a lot, how much does our health insurance make? How do you price our product? And they say, we look towards a penny and a half on the dollar profit. If we can make that, we're thrilled. A lot of companies lose money, a lot of companies make money. The thing is, they make money in a broad variety of products. You have health insurance, life insurance, disability insurance, all the products, they're all in one company. So it's really hard to see where the profits and losses are. I know one company, and I'll end with this, took $110 million loss in health insurance claims a couple years ago. That's a lot. And so, you know, they've got a lot of problems too, and they need those reserves to pay claims. Thank you.
Thanks, Linda. We're going to take Patrick, David, and then Roger.
Just to answer Mary's question there, it's real simple. If you've ever owned a boat or an airplane, and you went down to the store to buy a spark plug for a car, it was a certain price. If you added the words boat or airplane to that, the price tripled.
The car makes the same way.
Well, it made the exact same way. However, if the car crashes, the chances are insurance is going to cover nobody to sue them. If the airplane crashes, the relative out of woodwork, say the plane was inherently unsafe, and sue the pants off the manufacturer. And I think doctors face that, pharmaceutical companies face that, as part of it. I think the main reason, however, is that the market will bear it. That's right. There's somebody out there who's going to pay it, so we'll charge this. The two were together.
Right.
No, not at all.
That's irresponsible.
I agree.
It's irresponsible of us to put up with that for long.
I agree.
I mean, pocket theory. I think people are getting...
But those are the two things that drive it, and those are two things that are going to have to be addressed. Not only tort reform, but this idea that somebody's going to pay for it.
Yeah.
Huge issue all by itself, but no, it is clearly, and thanks. David?
Yeah, I'm taking what you said, especially about our technological capabilities ahead of us, but that gets back to what I was saying about the need to personally change our attitudes about limits. And for instance, it's not just someone like me who wants to stay in control of his years when he might not be allowed to be in control. It also has to do with where the limits ought to be in respect to whether it's organ transplant or where the dollars go. Now, clearly we're all going to be slow changing our attitudes and getting a different sense of what the limits of our own personal life must be. But it's not a very practical pressure to change the attitude unless those who are already of a firm opinion about where their own personal limits ought to be are in a legal position to have support and economic support for their actions. So that if I want to limit myself in whether I will ever accept organ transplant, let's say, there should be some way in the medical system, in the insurance system, in whatever kind of health provision there is, there should be some way where that person does and still pay through the nose when he's trying to stay in control and trying to limit his burden on society. But if he's trying to limit his burden by defining his own personal limits, then there should be some way in the system where that's recognized. Otherwise, there will be no living examples for other people to recognize and start adjusting their own personal point of view.
Roger?
Yeah, a couple of things that came up. One of which is, how do we ever get a handle on technology? What's worth paying for? What's not worth paying for? What is a recoverable incident? What is a preventable incident, etc.? And those are terribly complex issues. But they have been examined. They have been examined in the Aragon experiment. And, you know, like they said, there are 708 procedures which are payable, and they cut off at 400 and whatever. But the point is that they're graded. I would have no idea whether the Aragon system would pay for a premature birth whose death was anticipated. I don't know. But the point being, it's in the category somewhere, and it's either payable or not payable under that system. It's rationing. There's no doubt in my mind it's rationing, and people have to accept it, that if we're going to have any kind of a system which pays up front, it's going to be rationing. Otherwise, you have your own ability to pay for it. That's it. That's all there is. The other thing is, there is an increasing demand out there. We talk about technology, but let's also include the demand. Now, I have had personal experience with this when I was on the Medicaid Rate Commission. The state inherited a situation where during the flush years, the communities were able to build for themselves facilities which were unsupportable in terms of operational expense. Unsupportable. Now, you know, what do? We get grandma on Medicaid, Medicaid occupies the facility, and now the state's got to pay for it. And because of the law, the way it's written, access is guaranteed, and now we have the responsibility to pay for our social imperative years ago. What I'm trying to get at is that people have to understand the economic worth of what they're incurring. You cannot go to a facility with a Medicredit card and say it's covered. That will not fly. The communities can't go to the state, to society, and say, we've got the down payment. Now, you know, you guys come up with the rest. We can't do it.
Thank you. Yep, Ron?
To back up the lady that said she didn't have insurance, I went in there and I told my doctor, I says, I have insurance, but they refuse to pay. He says, well, then get a government job. They have good insurance. I says, well, then I'll come in with mental health claims. He says, okay. Then go marry some woman that's got good insurance. I mean, he didn't want to talk about me paying for it at all. He told me, go get insurance. Want any way you can get it, go get insurance.
Mary, and then Tracy.
I think it's a little naive of us to sit here and think that just because we're in America, in the United States of America, that we have the bad system, that we have had the bad system. Sure, it has some small problems, but it needs to be overhauled. Just because we are an American in the United States of America doesn't mean we know all end all as far as medicine, insurance companies, education, the list can go on and on and on. As somebody mentioned earlier, this is a world we live in. This is not a country. It does not stop at the borders. There are some incredible plans out there that have some merit, shoot. They're working, it's indisputable. There's a vast wealth of information out there to be drawn off of. And to sit here and think that we have to put up with this antiquated, broke down, miserable, you know, method of doing business that we've been dealing with for the past how many years, it's ridiculous. I wish I had an answer. All I can do is complain.
Teresa?
I have a couple of points. You talked about wanting to have some control over your decisions, and I've heard that in a couple of things here. And there was a report a couple of weeks ago in the Wall Street Journal, and already there are studies starting to come out on the live and will situation. They're not cost effective, at least not now. They took about a group of 100 that had them and a group that didn't, same types of illnesses, and they both spent about the same amount of money. So,
my understanding is that the living wills do not provide a basis for trust. You can do one, but it isn't effective.
That's right. And because of all the legality and liabilities, they're not doing what many of us thought they would do, increase education, increase access to information. And they're really not doing that yet. The other piece that, as the lady in the back talked about, the insurance companies, of how much technology can we afford. Well, it seems in Fairbanks we have a nurse who does education with high-risk moms, and the goal, of course, is to get those babies to full term before they're delivered. her cost or the charge that she charges is very minimal in comparison. It's less than $50 a session. No insurance company will pay for that as a preventive measure, but they will pay for the NICU when that baby's born. You know, and there's example after example of that kind of thing where you can't get your medications filled, but we'll pay for an ICU charge, you know, for 3 or 4 days because you couldn't, you know, you got into trouble because you didn't get your medications. So there's the flip-flop going on. We are paying for all that technology, and we're not willing to look at the other side of the coin of some of the less expensive types of therapies that work very, very well.
Please.
I'm just suspicious. The reason that is so is for them to sell an insurance policy, they can really put the threat in the intensive care unit compared to preventive health care. Is how they're selling insurance and how they can sell insurance. Through fear.
Nobody wins.
Yeah, it's a betting game. We're going to have to close because our time is upon us here. But I want to say, first of all, unless there are closing comments for you, thank you for coming out tonight. You clearly demonstrate that there is a constituency for this set of issues, that there's interest in what we're looking at. And I hope that you'll all stay engaged in the discussion as it continues to evolve at the federal level and, more importantly, at our state level. We will be making some recommendations. We've got all of this meeting taped. The other meetings around the state, we're going to have the benefit of listening to those tapes and that testimony as well. We hope that we present a rational plan for the state of Alaska, something that makes sense in our unique scheme of things, and that you'll let us know where we failed and where we might tweak and fine-tune that plan once it's made. But last comment, Herb?
Well, ask a question to you. If I heard correctly before, there's not a great deal of enthusiasm and leadership coming out of the administration at this time. So perhaps what you need to do is to recommend to us and others that you have at other hearings is to sit down and write a letter or send a poem to the governor or whoever else might be appropriate to raise the level of awareness of the issue.
Yes.
Absolutely. For those who don't know, the POM is a public opinion message that can be sent here, and you don't have to come down physically to make that POM. You can call it in. It's, I think the number is 452-4448. And you can call it in and send your public opinion message not only to an individual legislative member, but to the entire delegation or to the entire House or Senate or both, and also the governor. And clearly the governor needs to hear that there is a constituency for this issue, or the set of issues, and the people that are concerned about the outcome of where we're headed.
You can call the governor's office directly.
Absolutely. There's
Tim Hasselberg will be glad.
David.
Could I just ask one final question? Yeah. I came in a little bit late. You may have covered this, but the report here says final recommendations. Are you having another report?
Yes.
Right. There were two sets of. We had an interim report and then a final recommendation to the last legislature. We've had a 2-year life. Will effectively have been a 2-year life, and we are making a set of final recommendations to the next legislature that will convene in January.
And that'll take place when your recommendation.
February. Yeah. We actually make the recommendations in February, which by the time they are all sworn in and organized and sit down and learn where the bathroom is, they'll be, you know, they'll take the February to like. Jim?
Can I make one comment? Yeah. I'm Jim Gingrich, I'm the administrator of the hospital, but I want to thank all of you for being here tonight on behalf of the committee to help myself. There's a whole other set of ears in the room. Dr. Harding is very influential with a group of 125 doctors, very active with the medical staff. Anne's on the community hospital board, and I'm in charge of $60 million a year health care delivery system within the city of Montpelier. So I want you to feel like the comments that you said, took the time from your mind, we too have heard those. How do you eat an elephant one bite at a time? So if you take this information and try to do something with it as a consensus of European impairment. So I appreciate all of you taking the time to do that.
Thanks, Jim. Last comment, Karen?
No, I want to just underscore the concept that we will be back in some way. I'm not sure. We have your addresses here. I'm not sure if we can mail you all reports, but I'm going to try to get us to do that. And hopefully watch the media, because we will have a report out, and at that point, we'll need you again.
Yeah. Thank you again for coming out tonight. We don't, but you can have mine. Which one is it you don't have?
The interim. I don't remember seeing very much publicity.
We have tried and tried and tried and tried.
I was listening, you know, driving them. Robert Hannon interviewed.
Yeah, newspaper here is with Karen and Vivian KUEC on Monday.
Oh, that's so good.
Thanks, Pat.
And I was kind of, boy, why don't we know about it?
We did three interviews last week for television, and we tried to get the newspaper. The newspaper buried the notification of this meeting.
I've been looking in the public.
They buried it. You had to know that this notice was in part of something, a park meeting about a park advisory group.
If I hadn't heard that, in a little word, yeah. Pretty much.
That's right here, right?
If those guys couldn't do it, being part of an integral part.
I'm glad you did too. Thank you. Don't forget to leave your questionnaires for us too. We've got them.
Say, this is why that's wrong.
And it kind of got loose, and that's a real great wheel. I guess we could.